It is the main step towards stabilizing Alaska's future.
The Senate moves forward on a PFD plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 7th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, a new survey on campus sexual assault.
Due to shame and stigma that is very much still happening in our society with respect to victims of sexual violence.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The Senate passed a bill on Monday that would cut permanent fund dividends in half. It's part of a plan to change the basis for funding state government from a dependence on oil revenues to permanent fund earnings. But the plan is controversial. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau reports.
Bill sponsor Anchorage Republican Senator Liesl McGuire says the bill would make Alaskans more invested in the state budget, while providing a sounder, more predictable basis for funding government services.
This bill is the most important thing that I will do in my 16 years, and I would dare to say anyone here in this room will do in their political career. It is the main step towards stabilizing Alaska's future.
The bill would draw as much as 5.25% of the permanent fund from the fund's earnings account each year, and it would cut the PFD from its current level of roughly $2,000 to $1,000. After 3 years, the dividend checks would be based on a combination of 20% of oil royalties and 1% of the permanent fund. It should still equal about $1,000. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon supports the bill. She says it's a financially responsible way to provide necessary services. Without changes, the state runs the risk of exhausting its savings, imperiling all dividends, in a few years.
The bill before you maintains our savings account. It increases the longevity of how long those savings accounts can be around for future generations. It secures the corpus of the permanent fund.
Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski cites several reasons for opposing the bill. He says he's promised voters he'd protect their dividends, and he says the change isn't necessary.
People say, well, it's not really a tax, it's just cutting the dividend. It's semantics, in my opinion, and I think if you were to ask your constituents, and I know if I ask my constituents, all they know is it's $1,000 out of their pocket.
Wasilla Republican Senator Mike Dunleavy says he opposed the bill because the state could make deeper cuts to the budget next year, but the pressure to make those cuts could be reduced if the bill becomes law.
There's no doubt that the math would indicate over the long term that we're going to have to do something structurally. I just think we're probably a year or so too premature on this.
The Senate voted 14-5 to pass the bill. Governor Bill Walker applauded the vote, but he noted a concern about whether the impact of the budget changes are balanced. He's proposed other measures to raise revenue, including introducing a personal income tax. While the PFD changes would primarily affect middle and low-income Alaskans, the income tax would fall most heavily on higher-income residents. The House version of the permanent fund bill is up for a hearing in the House Finance Committee on Monday. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Candidates are running for Lisa Murkowski's U.S. Senate seat, but only one Murkowski challenger has already raised a sizable war chest, Anchorage attorney Margaret Stock. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the Democrats recruited Stock to run, but Stock insists she's not one of them.
Anchorage resident Robin Smith was listening to NPR one day when she heard an interview with a national immigration expert.
She just sounded really logical, laid it all out, and I was just like, wow. And I really liked her. And then at the end of the thing, they said, and Margaret Stock lives in Anchorage, Alaska.
Smith's an active Democrat and thought Stock would make a great candidate. So she reached out.
Actually, Kay Brown was involved with this.
Kay Brown, executive director of the Alaska Democratic Party.
Because we initially thought that she would run as a Democrat. We were hoping.
Smith says Stock couldn't be persuaded to be a Democrat, but still has her support. Stock raised nearly $250,000 in the first 3 months of her campaign. Most of the itemized total came from immigration attorneys in the lower 48. Stock says that's due to her reputation.
Well, I'm a very famous immigration attorney, so when other immigration attorneys heard that I was running for the Senate, yes, they generously contributed to my campaign.
Stock is in favor of abortion rights and says Murkowski has disappointed Alaskans with inconsistent votes. On illegal immigration, Stock says her position is like most Americans.
If you've lived in the country for a really long time and you don't have a criminal record and you speak English and you're paying your taxes, there ought to be a way for you to become legal, not get citizenship, but at least get a green card.
Alaskans contributed about 15% of Stock's itemized total, not counting the $25,000 the candidate herself put in. Several committed Democrats are among her Alaska donors. Stock, though, says she was a Republican most of her adult life. Anti-partisanship is a major theme of her campaign. Here's a web ad she's running.
Margaret Stock, Party Crasher. Margaret served our nation for 28 years in the Army and Army Reserve.
She first came to Alaska as a military police officer. She has degrees from Harvard Law and the Kennedy School of Government, but says she nearly ended her education after her father died when she was 15.
My family fell apart as a result of losing him. I ended up in a teenage homeless shelter for a while. I dropped out of high school.
She credits a school guidance counselor for helping her get into college. Later, as an immigration attorney with military experience, she created programs to help the Pentagon recruit immigrants and expedite their citizenship. That work won her a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2013. It comes with 5 annual checks of $125,000. She says it frees her from the demands of earning a living.
Why run against Lisa Murkowski?
People ask me to. Alaskans came forward and asked me to run against her. They were a lot of people over a period of many months.
Stock says people of all parties asked her to run. The only Alaskans she named are frequent donors to Democratic campaigns. She says others worry about political retribution. Republican Party Communications Director Suzanne Downing says she's studied Stock's reported campaign contributions and thinks they show the fingerprints of former Senator Mark Begich.
Absolutely. She is using Mark Begich's list. He is helping her.
Stock scoffs at the idea.
He has not helped me raise money, no. He's a Democrat. I'm an independent.
Yes. Has he helped you in any way?
He contributed to my campaign.
Begich says he's not working for Stock's campaign or raising money for her.
She's asked for views from me and thoughts on issues, which I've given her. And, if anyone asks me, I'd be happy to tell them what I think.
Stock did, though, get some Democratic help with contributions. Her financial report shows she hired Katz Watson, a D.C.-based Democratic fundraising firm. The campaign says they've since dropped the company. While Stock tries to shake off party labels, she did work to associate herself with former state senator Arliss Sterjalewski, which the now independent elder stateswoman didn't appreciate.
Was a bit embarrassing.
At issue was a quote Sterjalewski has deployed over the years.
I didn't leave the Republican Party. The party left me.
Stock posted it on social media with her campaign logo beneath Sterjalewski's name. Sterjalewski says it implied she had endorsed Stock.
The Stock campaign used it in a good deal of publicity, and I think it was done for, raising of money. I have never met Margaret.
Sterjalewski supports Murkowski and says she would even if they weren't related. Sterjalewski's son is married to Murkowski's sister. Without a party primary to run in, Stock is gathering signatures to get on the November ballot. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the fight to save Ketchumak Bay.
It's a local, human-scale fight over sort of our human destiny with great characters and great arguments on all sides.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to a four-year college or other post-secondary education. Explore your talents and develop your dreams at Mount Edgecombe High School. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Two unions representing workers on tugboats and barges in Prince William Sound are calling out the operator of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. They say the plan to bring in a Louisiana-based company to take over oil spill prevention and response in the Sound risks another spill, 27 years after the Exxon Valdez. APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Alan Cote is president of the Inland Boatmen's Union, or IBU, and he calls the public campaign unprecedented.
I have never endeavored anything as big as this and as important as this in my career in the union.
Together, the IBU and another union, the International Organization of Masters, Mates, and Pilots, represent about 230 people in Prince William Sound. That's everyone from cooks to captains on the tugboats that escort oil tankers in and out of the Sound, and the barges available 24/7 in case of a spill. They work for Crowley Marine Services, which has held at least part of the contract since the response system was first set up after the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989. But this week, the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, which operates the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, confirmed it's in final negotiations with a different company, Louisiana-based Edison Schuest Offshore, to take over.
They'll work in Alaska, but they'll live in Louisiana.
The unions have launched a campaign to stop that contract, airing ads in Anchorage and Juneau that warn darkly of Louisiana workers coming for Alaska jobs. And in part, it is a fight over jobs. Edison Schuest isn't unionized. Crowley's current workforce is about half Alaska residents, and unions worry they'll be replaced by outsiders. But Cote argues the fight is bigger than that. He points out it was an Edison Schuest tugboat pulling Shell's Arctic drill rig, the Kulik, when it grounded off Kodiak in 2012. And he says Alyeska is trying to cut costs at the expense of the Sound.
I was there in 1989. I saw what happened to Prince William Sound. It was devastating. I never want to see that again.
Everyone down there has years of training and experience.
That's Carl Jones, who worked as an engineer on Crowley tugboats for about 15 years.
And to think that a company from outside could come in and replace 25 years of experience in one day, 10 days, or 100 days, it can't happen.
He says there's no good reason to replace a system that's working with newcomers who are unfamiliar with the weather, tides, and geography of a notoriously difficult place to operate. Edison Schuest didn't reply to an interview request in time for this story, but Michelle Egan, a spokesperson for Alyeska, says the pipeline operator is confident the Louisiana company will meet its safety and environmental standards.
Any company that works with us has to meet the expectations of the response plan in Prince William Sound, which are very rigorous, and they have to be demonstrated repeatedly through drills and exercises. So there are many opportunities for us to identify if there are gaps and then to help bridge those gaps.
Egan says there's no specific Alaska hire requirement for the contract, but Alyeska does require all contractors to employ 20% Alaska Native workers, and she expects Edison Schuest would hire locally, at least in part. Alyeska expects to finalize the contract this summer. Edison Schuest would take over in July of 2018. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
An interagency raid surprised a number of people in Bethel this morning. According to witnesses, Alaska State Troopers and FBI agents raided several homes in the city's trailer court. Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters says multiple search warrants were being served to people involved with illegal alcohol sales and distribution by local companies in Bethel. Officers with uniforms bearing the logos of the Troopers, FBI, and Bethel Police searched what appeared to be the vehicles used by the Kuyana Cab Company. Peters says the investigation is ongoing and would offer little more information. Peter says the Troopers' Western Alaska Alcohol and Narcotics Team has been investigating the illegal sales since December of last year. The remains of a person who died in a fire at a Kodiak Lodge last week have been identified. According to Alaska State Troopers, Silvana Sotano, a 59-year-old Indonesian national, died when fire gutted the main guest cabin of the Spirit of Alaska Wilderness Lodge at Uyak Bay. Four guests of the lodge were sleeping in the cabin when the fire broke out. Sean Ghazali, a 30-year-old Indonesian national, and Tayari Kim, a 33-year-old South Korean national, were able to escape through a window. Danielle Ghazali, a 22-year-old Indonesian national, was pulled out of the burning structure by the owner of the lodge. The three survivors were transported to the Kodiak Hospital for treatment of their injuries by a Coast Guard helicopter early that morning. Sean and Danielle Ghazali were then flown to Seattle for further treatment. Tayari Kim was treated at the hospital in Kodiak. The Indonesian and Korean consulates were notified of the incident. The cause of the fire is still under investigation. A new survey of University of Alaska students shows that 1 in 9 students have been the victim of sexual misconduct or sexual assault. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The federally funded Campus Climate Survey questioned 2,000 male and female students at the University of Alaska's three main campuses between January 2015 and the 2016 spring semester. UAA Justice Center Assistant Professor Lindsay Blumenstein, who led the survey project, points to disturbing results.
The number that most people are going to identify with is that 1 in 9, approximately 1 in 9 University of Alaska students have been the victim of sexual misconduct and/or sexual assault.
More than a third of respondents who reported being victimized said they were the victims of an attempted or completed sexual assault. Results vary slightly by type of offense at the three UA campuses. Dr. Blumenstein says the overall UA results are similar to those from other schools where the survey has also been conducted.
The most recent study that was done by the Bureau of Justice Statistics with the Office of Violence Against Women looked at 9 schools. And they used the Campus Climate Survey. And while their time frames differ slightly, their average across the schools was about 10%.
The survey asked very specific questions in an attempt to get accurate information about the prevalence of a range of behaviors, from sexual comments to rape. Blumenstein says the online survey lends itself to better accuracy, but contends the results represent conservative estimates.
Due to shame and stigma that is very much still happening in our society with respect to victims of sexual violence, it is very difficult for people to come forward, even on a computer screen.
Blumenstein cautions that the survey results are a measure of what's going on in students' lives on and off campus and are not a direct assessment of campus safety, but can be used to improve it.
By knowing a general idea of how many victims there are, that allows us to make sure that we're providing the correct number of resources.
The University of Alaska campuses have implemented new sexual misconduct and assault prevention, awareness, and reporting initiatives following federally required Title IX compliance reviews. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
In remote southeast communities, electricity costs for local businesses can be through the roof. businesses don't qualify for power cost equalization, a state program that subsidizes energy costs for private residents. But a small federal grant could help businesses identify some simple ways to save. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports.
When you hear the word audit, good things may not come to mind. You might think about the IRS peeking into your personal accounts, finding you owe more on your taxes.
Sometimes I call it an assessment, so we don't get that negative connotation with it.
Shana Kilcoyne is a director at the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. She says this audit is something businesses might want to sign up for.
The level of energy audit we're doing is really just trying to get an understanding of how the building is using energy.
Up to 26 Southeast businesses can request the energy audit, and the grant covers most of the cost. Kilcoyne says think of it as more of a workshop. After businesses turn over 2 years of electricity and heating info, an energy auditor stops by and makes suggestions.
Some of the easier ones are efficient lighting. LEDs have become a lot more affordable and are much more efficient than some of the older lighting. Weatherization, we see a lot of cracks in doors and windows.
And those suggestions can save big bucks, especially in communities that run primarily off diesel. In Hoonah last year, the energy auditor recommended LED lights in the harbor and gym.
And they were having trouble keeping the gym open. It cost so much to run.
After the switch, the city saved $17,000. Kilcoyne says this year they're considering offering the energy audits to commercial fishing vessels, too. And later on, the final reports could help businesses qualify for loans to finance the more expensive improvements. Even though that's money spent, Kilcoyne thinks it's also money saved.
That could go back to, you know, staying open longer or hiring more people or expanding their business.
The Renewable Energy Alaska Project is administering the $95,000 grant. It was awarded to Southeast Conference, an economic development organization based in Juneau. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
The environmental group Cook Inlet Keeper recently sponsored a panel discussion to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the Kachemak Bay oil and gas lease buyback. In the first of two reports, KBBI's Jenny Nyman tells how local fishermen were instrumental in getting the bay designated as a critical habitat area.
It was a story. It was a David and Goliath, a little town in Homer at the end of the Sterling Highway, is under pressure from those big oil companies.
In one corner, David was a motley crew of commercial fishermen, Homer's budding environmental movement, including Frank Tupper, heard here, and other Homer residents desperate to protect Kachemak Bay. In the other were oil companies and the state of Alaska, which in December 1973 held a Lower Cook Inlet lease sale that opened up the bay to drilling and production activities. What followed was a 3-year battle fought in all three branches of state government and all aspects of the community. On May 25th, Cook Inlet Keeper sponsored a panel discussion to commemorate the 40th anniversary of these events.
It was a local human scale fight over sort of our human destiny with great characters and great arguments on all sides.
That's Tom Keziah, editor of the Homer News at the time.
Homer really changed as a consequence of what happened in that period. I think you can see a lot of the what Homer became was sort of seeded and started to grow at that time.
The seeds of environmentalism flourished from that fight, and the community became centered on tourism and fisheries rather than oil and gas. Lauren Flagg was the commercial fisheries area biologist for Fish and Game when the lease sale was announced and had all of 2 days to prepare comments.
At that time, the bay was producing 5 million pounds of shrimp a year, 2 million pounds of king crab, 500,000 pounds of tanner crab, and of course salmon, halibut. It was extremely, extremely valuable resources.
But Governor Bill Egan supported the sale, so it went ahead, much to the surprise of Homer residents. The sale had been announced through the usual governmental and industry channels, but not in a way that reached community members. Ken Moore fished crab, herring, and salmon in the bay. He says fishermen felt like they didn't have a say in the matter.
No effort to find out if the people whose front yard it was all going to be in wanted it there, or it didn't seem that anybody really cared whether they did or not. It had happened already. And that just added insult to injury when you discovered what was going on.
Frank Tupper was making ends meet as a self-proclaimed hippie at the time when a friend came by his trailer to tell him about the pending lease sale.
Neither one of us could believe that that would be possible, that people were not that stupid, that they wouldn't just do it just for the dollars. Naive we were, but still that's what we thought because of this beautiful intrinsic area that you live in. So I think I said to Chuck, I said, well, damn it, there's two of us, let's get going. And that, from the citizen side of it, that was the beginning of going out and just beating the streets and talking to people. Do you know what's coming? Do you know what's coming?
Such was the grassroots of the community campaign that eventually gained national attention. Activists established the Ketchikan Bay Defense Fund, led by Tupper. They joined forces with the North Pacific Fishermen's Association, led by Moore, to spread the word of the oil incursion into the bay and raise money for a legal challenge. A popular tactic was to hold shrimp and crab feeds, serving up information and donation forms along with the shellfish.
I would hold up a quart of oil, and I would say, after they were wiping their mouths with the butter and the garlic and everything, I said, now which would you prefer in the bay?
The fund helped pay for legal challenges to the leases. The issue made it to the Supreme Court. Warren Matthews was an attorney for the plaintiffs. They brought three challenges. Failure to give notice, they lost on that one. Failure to make a reasoned decision that the lease sale was in the best interest of the state, and failure to conduct a study of potential impacts to be shared with affected communities. The court found merit in those two claims, but not enough to reverse the sale.
A majority of the court said, well, you're right. Do we want to disturb all these other leases that have been made in the past? They answered no, and therefore we're not going to apply this ground to you either.
But political tides were changing. Republican Jay Hammond was elected governor in 1974, in part on his conservationist platform to protect fisheries. I'm Jenny Nyman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jenny Nyman in Homer, Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, and Charles Enoch in Bethel. Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Our producer is Ellen Lockyer. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a lovely evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Business Administration program at Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Move forward with APU and apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.